On the Empire Podcast this week, Derek C. in France drops by to tell us all about the light between oceans and also how to pronounce the C in France. Plus, we say a sad goodbye to one of our own on the movie podcast. It doesn't really feel like doing a funny bit here. Sorry about that. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up, it's our geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hello.
And last but not least, for the final time in the podcast, at least for now, is our pint-sized lover of film scores and hater of trailers, Emma Thrower.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm okay. This is sad.
It is sad.
It's a sad time in the pod booth.
It's a bit like being at your own funeral, isn't it, in a way, weird way?
I mean, all the greys suddenly seem really colourful.
Oh, gosh.
I'm seeing it in a new light.
Well, we're off to a good start. Some background. Emma is leaving us this week. We're not happy about it.
No.
Least of all, Emma. How are you? How are you?
I mean,
as your consigliere, as your priest, tell me how you're feeling right now.
I feel better being in here with you two right now. This is a happy place.
Is it that bad outside? I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine. I'm still going to be doing lots of stuff for the mag.
Good.
So please, Helen and Chris.
Absolutely.
Haven't completely got rid of me.
You are also, we should mention at this point, you know, doing a marathon. I want to mention this, but as another runner, you're doing the Brighton Marathon next year.
Yeah, apparently so.
So really, this is going to be a brave new dawn of like just running all day for you, right?
Yeah, basically. Just all day.
Yeah,
every day.
Forrest Gump style.
Away from the fact that I chose to do the marathon. I've never run before, so this is going to be hilarious for everyone involved.
Wow. Have you started training for your marathon?
Yeah, I did on Monday.
How was that?
Yeah, day one was fine. Day two, not so fine.
So day one was 10 minutes, right?
Yeah.
And day two was
easy.
Is that the mandated? Is that suggested that you go? Because obviously, marathon's quite long.
Yeah, I've heard so.
You don't start off with the full 26.2 miles,
no,
do you?
No. The Nike, other apps are available. App tells you sort of what you can do for a marathon. So
yeah.
I've got 5 months because I'm an anarchist. It's kind of exciting, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be cool.
It's going to be awesome. It's going to be really awesome. Have you chosen a costume?
No, although Ollie says I should go as Chappie. And
yes.
I mean,
who else is going to go as Chappie? Literally no one.
The potential there is just it's almost limitless.
I'm not
as with Chappie himself
counting it out. So as with Chap, thank you for realising that in Chappie. We'll see. Probably not.
Okay.
Though, let's be honest.
All right. Well, we have asked as is tradition, whenever we bid someone farewell on the podcast, it's always very sad. But here's an upside: we bid Helen farewell on the podcast. When was it? 2 years ago.
That's right.
And you're still here.
Well, you're having trouble getting rid of me.
The problem is, it's two doors. I can only monitor one door at a time.
You can only close one at a time.
Yeah, there's also the ceiling.
Yep.
You've come through there in the past.
Only a few times, and the trapdoor has been enormously useful. And then, of course, I've made a little nest under the desk.
And also, while we're on the subject of hey, it's not all shit, Emma Thrower. I left Empire in 2007.
You did, yeah.
Yeah, I left Empire in 2007, and just when they thought I was out, I pulled myself back in.
Yeah, nobody pulled him back in. He pulled himself.
So basically, I'm not leaving.
So basically, you're not leaving.
Oh, amazing.
And I just, and also what I meant with the running thing is, as well as raising money for a good cause and all this kind of stuff, you're also learning to outrun our security guard, Mick, downstairs, who's a lovely man. I think you're faster than him.
I think I might be.
So I think you can get back in, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
Yeah, there are glaciers that are faster than Mick.
Mick is a very fine Irish gentleman, and I will not hear a word against him.
Oh, of course not. No, absolutely not. I wouldn't dream of it, but I'm just saying.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll give it my best shot.
So anyway, yes, do not throw away your shot.
There it is.
Oh.
Sorry.
Jesus Christus. Okay, so we've asked the good listeners for a bunch of questions for Emma. I'm going to move the running order of the podcast around a little bit this week. So we're going to start with movie news, and then we're going to go into movie reviews, and we're going to finish with the Emma question-a-thon that you guys have been so kind to send in loads of stuff via Twitter. So I hope you don't mind that. Nice to keep things moving, mix things around. So we're going to start with movie news. So, what's been happening?
There was a really weird story yesterday that I'd just like to flag up. Johnny Depp will apparently be appearing in the Fantastic Beasts sequel. That's the second of the five planned movies. There are five planned movies, neither to four nor to six movies, shall you count? And there are rumours, now that is the official report, that he will be in the sequel. There are rumours that he makes a very, very, very fast, very short cameo in this first film that we will be seeing very, very soon now. And also that he is playing Gellert Grindelwald, who I think we all remember.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
What?
As the dark wizard who Dumbledore beat in a duel, and which a duel that established Dumbledore's reputation as like he who shall not be messed with, right? But there are also like some snippets, some rumors, some sense in the Harry Potter universe that he may also once have been Dumbledore's boyfriend. So
what?
Yeah, because they were like passionate good buddies, and we know that Dumbledore is canonically gay, so it may have been a love affair. So that could be the role. Apparently, that is the rumoured role that Johnny Depp will be playing in the Fantastic Beasts sequel or even first film. Who knows? We shall find out very soon. Johnny Depp, though. I mean, So there you go.
Johnny Depp. That's an amazing way to stop that. Johnny Depp, everybody.
Like, I don't know.
Well,
isn't that a thing?
I don't know what to say because I'm actually genuinely really excited about it.
Because Johnny Depp in a movie now, I mean, Johnny Depp in a movie now, these days, right now, means something means something very different from when you would cast Johnny Depp a year ago, even.
That is correct.
Because of all the things that have gone on in his private life, which I'm not sure we should discuss necessarily on a friendly podcast like this, but that's just say
it feels odd.
Yeah.
But I guess you can see why they might think that he would be a good addition to a franchise.
And you could also argue that perhaps Team Depp feels that some rehabilitation
might be in order.
It might be in order, and what better way than to start taking supporting roles in movies like Murder on the Orient Express and Fantastic Beasts series going forward, where it won't be on his shoulders, and certainly the publicity won't be based around him, as you imagine it will be with the new Pirates movie.
Maybe so, yeah.
When that comes out.
But a bad guy role, interesting as well there.
Anywho,
so that's a piece of news that is happening.
That is definitely something that is happening. Well done. Well done, Johnny Depp.
Another Disney live-action film is happening, obviously, because, God forbid, we go a week without another one being announced. But actually, that sounded really down on it. I'm quite excited about all of these still, because I think so far they've been quite good, haven't they? Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Some have been middling, but there's been nothing truly terrible.
There's been nothing terrible, no. Yeah. I mean, Jungle Book, great.
Was great.
Cinderella, really surprisingly charming. I didn't expect to like it, and I totally loved it.
And so. I have a lot of love for Maleficent. I don't love it. I mean, Charlotte Copley's in it, so obviously.
Yeah, but there's some great stuff in there.
Yeah. So it's the turn of Snow White this time.
Ah, the original.
The absolute original. And what's quite exciting is that they're looking at the people who did the songs from La La Land to do the songs in this. Which,
interesting.
So I guess we're going to get a whole batch of new staff.
Yeah.
And that could be really lovely because...
As well as the original staff?
Well, we don't know. We were sort of saying we'd expect to hear sort of Whistle While You Work.
The Hi-Ho
song. There'll be some new stuff. But I guess it would be like with a Jungle Book, though they didn't have new songs, they put in a few of the old things. I love the idea of these guys doing the songs though, because although, I mean, the film's not out until January, but we've all seen it, haven't we?
Yeah, we have.
And the songs are really dreamy.
La La Land, I haven't seen.
The girls in the room have seen La La Land, and the songs are really dreamy and
sexist.
Super lovely, and I think they'll lend a really lovely sort of tone and element to that. Obviously, there's no casting or director attached yet. This is very, very early days. But there's another Snow White story, obviously, also in the works about her lesser-known fairy tale sister, Rose Red, who also has a movie in the works at Disney too. So all of a Snow White very soon.
A lot of Snow White. I mean, she's obviously a big part of Once Upon a Time, which is big for them. So I guess that's probably, part of the impetus towards it. You mentioned directors. Directors have been dropping like flies recently, haven't they?
Segue.
Thank you. Tim Miller obviously left Deadpool 2 and is now moving on to apparently produce and perhaps direct, who knows, Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yeah.
This is a strange one.
Isn't it, though? I mean, I guess like Sonic is a bit funny and such, so there could be you know, potential to kind of build on that Daredevil tone, maybe? I don't know. I'll be honest, I don't really play games except for Freezel.
Oh, you mean Daredevil as in small d?
Sorry, I meant Deadpool.
It's an easy thing to make.
It's an easy mistake to make. I'm sorry.
I thought you were being like clever with the play on words.
Let's say that I was.
Let's say that you were. This is a very interesting decision by Tim Miller. Obviously, it seems like there were that old chestnut creative differences on Deadpool 2. Apparently, he wanted to make it big and splashy and special effectsy, and everyone else didn't. But who knows? But certainly, Sonic the Hedgehog, I'm not sure about that. But, of course, it looks like David Leitch, who is the director of John Wick, and John Wick Chapter 2 is in the running. Hasn't been officially confirmed, but is in the running. Very, very strongly rumoured to be the director of Deadpool 2.
That would seem like a good fit.
Seems like a good fit. Certainly, action-wise, seems like a good fit. Comedy-wise, I'm not so sure. John Wick does have a sense of humour.
Oh, it really does.
The film does, not John Wick himself, necessarily.
Well, there's a little bit there.
When he's
chatting to the police officer, and you know, when he's chatting to the concierge, he's kind of funny.
Yeah, he's not going to do a stand-up set anytime soon, but
if he did, though, you would laugh.
Well, you would, because
you'd be terrified of him.
Imagine if you didn't. So that could be good. David Leitch, the action certainly in John Wick is really, really good, and it's very interesting to keep an eye on those two films.
Yeah. Also, in director news, Rick Famuyiwa has left The Flash, following in the departing steps of Seth Graham Smith. So that's two directors down for this movie.
Excuse Tim Miller.
Might be confusing with Ezra Miller.
I would never confuse anyone with Ezra Miller.
Okay,
we established this, haven't we?
And Kiersey Clemons and Billy Crudup are also cast. I mean, it's supposed to be shooting in March, so they're slightly running out of time on this one. It sounds like, again, creative differences, but Famuyiwa has said a little bit more than some might in this circumstance. Mm-hmm. He says, I pitched a version of the film in line with my voice, humour and heart. It's disappointing we couldn't come together creatively on the project. Blah, blah, blah. But it sounds like there were rumours was that he was going in a more sort of slightly edgy direction with the character, and the executives were kind of wary of that. I mean, without wishing to in any way doubt Ezra Miller, who I think is great, do we need a Flash movie? We have The Flash on TV and he's great.
Unfortunately, Helen, because we have the Justice League.
Yeah.
Of course we do.
Oh.
Because we have to set up all these individual... Because nobody knows who they are, apparently.
Well, I mean, by that logic, where's my Black Widow movie? Do you know what I mean?
That's a whole different story.
Where's my Coulson movie? Whatever happened to that guy after he got killed in The Avengers? Nothing. I haven't seen him. This is... I don't know what to say about this. I mean, it just feels a little bit like that old... Is there really someone actively in charge of all those movies over at Warner Brothers? Is there a clear direction for that series?
They have a team, Chris, you know this.
Yeah,
we've just got to hope for the best.
It feels almost surprising, though, because you'd think they almost need to take a gamble and do something. You'd think they'd want to go edgier. Marvel, I'm not saying Marvel play safe, but Marvel have a much more, you know, tried and tested formula. Works great. But DC still haven't found their kind of groove, have they? So you'd think it'd be fun to have an edgy Flash, something different. I think people would really appreciate it.
I thought that the DC movies were setting themselves up as more direct actors' movies, and that's very harsh on people like the Russos and Scott Derrickson and Shane Black, who've really injected their own personalities into the Marvel movies. But Marvel movies also, we've said this on the podcast before, feel a little bit more like the Bond movies, where they are producer driven and you have the directors come in and the directors try as best they can to inject themselves into the movie, working in that system. Whereas the Warner Brothers movies from the off, the likes of Zack Snyder and James Wan and Rick Famuyiwa and people like that, who just seem a little bit more directory, if you will, and have their own directory. And they bring their own style and their own vision to movies. But yeah, I'm not so sure how that works with committee filmmaking and executives and people second-guessing each other and all that sort of stuff. It's certainly interesting.
Mm. Speaking of committees and people second-guessing each other and renaming their films several times, she said in an awkward segue, Doug Liman's been talking about an Edge of Tomorrow sequel.
Yes!
Now, I freaking love Edge of Tomorrow. In fact, I think everybody who's seen Edge of Tomorrow freaking loves Edge of Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. The problem is that the name was terrible. They couldn't decide on the name, and no one is quite sure if they've seen it or not as a result. Isn't it Live, Die, Repeat?
No. Anyway,
it was fantastic. And Doug Liman's been talking about it. He said that is the only sequel that I'm considering doing, and it's because, first of all, the story is so amazing, much better than the original film, and I loved the original film. And second of all, it's a sequel that's a prequel. people. Now, I have some issues with that, but fine. But he also says, I have some radical ideas about how to make a sequel that would interest me. And he says it's unlike how anybody else makes a sequel. And this script and this idea fits perfectly with that idea. It's going to revolutionise how people make sequels.
I mean, bring it on, right?
Okay.
Now,
wow.
Like, swing for the fences. Yeah. This is that's some big talk, and I really hope he can live up to that.
Yeah, he said it's like his favourite script, didn't he, that he's ever done?
Yeah, pretty much. He's excited, you know, and that's got to be a good thing, surely.
Yeah, I've heard good things about the script. I don't know what the premise is, but I've heard that this script is very, very good indeed. Yeah, I loved Edge of Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. So much.
It's really, so really great. And a sequel to that movie, which seems so perfect in itself.
Yeah.
And it ends really well. And how can you possibly do a sequel to that with prequel elements? I'm intrigued.
Because time travel.
Because time travel.
Because straws on tables and stuff, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Perhaps Noah Taylor will come in and explain it to us in a 10-minute sequence.
We've had Shane Carruth in here. I'm sure we could get him back.
Yeah. Yeah, of course. I'm sure that'll be fine. I look forward to the 6-hour spoiler special podcast with Chris McQuarrie. I know, again, but I didn't understand it, Chris. Again, and then he just takes me through it. No, I didn't understand it. Again.
Okay, there is one wall in here that we could easily cover with a whiteboard and a whole lot of pieces of string.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what we're going to need.
Yeah,
it'll
make David
fun.
Warner's flat in The Omen look like just normal wallpaper. Very, very excited. And other directors I'm really excited about include Gareth Evans.
No, you've never mentioned him.
I've never mentioned him. He hasn't been in the podcast for ages because he hasn't made a film in ages.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
But of course he was at Empire Live.
He was at Empire Live.
Yeah.
But he's rectifying that. He's so desperate to appear in the Empire podcast. This is my theory. He's so desperate to appear in the Empire podcast that he's decided to make another movie.
Wow.
And that movie is called Apostle.
Dude, be chill.
The lengths people will go to appear in this thing, honestly, is amazing. So it's very little is known about it, except the fact that it's going to be completely and utterly, as Evans himself said a couple months ago, fucked up. And it's about a man who heads to a remote island to look for his missing sister. She's been kidnapped by a religious cult, and he begins to dig into the cult, and the cult haven't quite bargained on this guy.
Ooh.
Now, that feels very Wicker Man to me. And Gareth Evans is a big horror fan. Obviously, he's known for The Raid and Raid 2, which are action epics, but he's a big, big horror guy as well. So I would imagine this one will be dark, intense, bloody, claustrophobic, bleak, all of the above. And I'm very, very excited to see him back behind the camera because I know he's been trying to make a couple of movies and hasn't quite got there. He's sticking to his guns. This is a man who I imagine could have his choice of Hollywood stuff. And he's sticking to his guns and making his own movies.
Hey.
More power to him, I say.
Absolutely. Some exciting trailers this week that we should mention in passing. There's the Bananas XXX, the Return of Xander Cage trailer, which we had a lot of fun watching yesterday.
I mean, they're just trying to turn it into Fast and Furious 9, aren't they? Aren't they?
Yes.
There's an introduction of a team. Xander Cage has a team now, obviously, because why wouldn't he?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if this one's going to be knowingly... Like, the Fast Five knows it's an outrageous, stupid, ludicrous, bad movie, and I'm not so sure.
How dare you?
Yeah, it is. And I'm not so sure that XXX will be quite as knowing.
Well, we can hope. But, it's certainly worth a look if you like, you know, people just doing stupidly impossible things. T2 Trainspotting sequel also got a sequel just this morning as we record this.
That title's getting clumsier by the second, isn't it?
It's very confusing for film fans, I'll be honest. I think we should maybe just call it Trainspotting 2.
I think we should, because I think they clearly went, let's call it T2 and forgot that Terminator 2 existed.
Yeah. So it's very a lot of kind of callbacks to the original film, but I don't know. I don't feel like they're going to just retread the original film, so I feel like they might be putting every single callback in the trailer and none at all in the rest of the movie. But have a look and see what you think. It's very exciting to see Johnny Lee Miller back in his peroxide hair, that's for sure, and Robert Carlyle off the chain again, which is kind of fun. And then if after all that you need something a bit more heartwarming, a bit more tear-jerking, and a bit handsomer, Chris Evans's Gifted trailer is out, and I highly recommend a little look at that. No reason.
Does he grab a helicopter by his bare hands?
No, he's just really charming with a small child.
Oh,
yes. All of his smaller films people haven't seen are amazing. So yeah, let me take this last podcast opportunity to tell you all to seek out all his films.
All of them.
Please, especially Snowpiercer. But
Snowpiercer, yes.
I mean, that's not a small film, let's be fair, but just go through his IMDb, right?
Yeah, just watch all of those.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one he directed is also pretty good. It's got a really generic title. It's Before You Go. Before We Go. Before We Go. See, I already forgot it again. Yeah.
That's amazing. You looked it up.
I did.
And then you instantly forgot it.
I did.
And there might be the problem I didn't do well at the box office.
But it's cute.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Sweet.
Cute.
Right. I got a couple of last things to talk about.
Bring it.
So, very excited to know that Liam Neeson and Neil Jordan are going to be working together again
mm-hmm.
on a film called The Trainer, which is set in Ireland. It's about a top horse trainer played by Liam Neeson who suffers a terrible tragedy that sees him lose everything he cares for. I'm literally reading this off the Empire Empire News story. But instead of then tracking down everyone who's responsible for that and making them pay,
as
Neeson
would be
style,
his want. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a more gentle drama about him being coaxed back into the world of horse training. And incidentally, the character's name is John Moore. It might be a stealth story about the making of A Good Day to Die Hard. You never know.
It could be.
And of course, someone who was on the podcast, was part of the podcast team most recently, Noel Clark. He has a new movie. He mentioned when he was in here that there's a couple movies that were maybe going to go. And one of them has been announced this week. It's a film called 10x10, and it stars Ruddy Bloody Luke Evans. We love the man. And Kelly Riley, who's never been in the podcast. See, she's making a movie. Clearly what's happening. And it's going to be a movie that takes place entirely in a, well, not entirely, I'm guessing, but entirely, well, he said entirely again, mostly in a 10x10 room/cage that Luke Evans' character has built for Kelly Riley's character. He's going to kidnap her and do horrible things to her, but is there more to it than meets the eye? I don't know, but probably yes.
Wow.
Yeah, so Susie Ewing is going to direct that, and Noel Clark has just written it and produced it.
Cool.
Yeah, fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nice and easy. All right, that is it for movie news. A lot of movie news this week.
Yeah, busy week.
That was a longer section than I'd bargained for. Time now for this week's guest. Derek C. N. France has established a name for himself as a maker of emotionally searing dramas, including Blue Valentine and The Place Beyond the Pines. And he cements that reputation with this week's The Light Between Oceans, which stars Michael Fassbender, Alicia Vikander, and Rachel Weisz in a period melodrama involving lots of sobbing. C.N. France came into our gloriously dreary prod booth recently, and he was speaking to the gloriously undreary Phil Dissimulian. Enjoy.
Derek C.N. France, welcome to the Empire Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We are here to talk about The Light Between Oceans today. It must have been a great location scouting job, this one.
Was.
I mean, it's obviously the lighthouse is pivotal.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a limited number of places you can shoot.
Yeah.
Unless you build your own. Was there any talk of doing that?
There was talk of doing that. I mean, to me, what was important was finding a place that was isolated, because this movie is all about what happens when people get into a relationship and isolate themselves and make decisions and keep secrets from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
To me, it was kind of a metaphor to what I felt when I was a kid growing up, that like I felt like I lived on an island as a kid, because when people would come to visit us, we would change. My family would change. Yeah. We'd become like the perfect versions of ourselves. And then people would leave and we'd go back to being real again.
Where did you grow up?
Lakewood, Colorado.
Right.
Suburbs of Denver. And so I kind of always made it my life's mission to take pictures of the arguments in my house, or record people fighting. Or like when I went to Disneyland with my family, I didn't take any video at Disneyland. I took video of my father changing a flat tire on the side of the desert, you know, in the highway in the desert. So anyway, I was interested in those, like the things that you didn't see, you know. And so for this movie, I wanted to find an isolated place that would stand in for anyone's home, for that suburban home in which I grew up, you know. And so I searched all over Australia for 6 months. I found a great location in Australia. We were all set to shoot there, and then Pirates of the Caribbean 5 flew into town and they took the tax credit.
Oh, what?
And we couldn't afford to shoot the movie there.
So this would have been in Queensland?
No. We were. I went Western Australia, but I also looked at Tasmania.
Right.
I was just drawn to Tasmania. So when we got kind of, when we were unable to shoot in Australia, we started looking in New Zealand. And just basically, you just look up every island lighthouse that they have in New Zealand. And I found a perfect one, but it had like an indigenous population of endangered lizards. And they wouldn't allow human beings on the island. So I couldn't shoot there. And then I found another one, Center Island, which is an island, but the lighthouse was very squat, very short, very stubby, as Michael Fassbender would say.
Right.
And it felt like it wasn't right for us. You know, so I found this place called Cape Campbell, and it was like an hour and a half down a bumpy dirt road, from the nearest population. And, you know, so I told the studio, I said, hey, I found the place. And they said, you can't shoot there because you're going to be in a commute for 3 hours a day driving to and from your hotel room. And I said, well, what happens if we just live there? Yeah. And they said, Derek, this isn't one of your little indie movies. This is a studio picture. You're going to have 100 people on your crew. You have to house them somewhere. And I said, well, do I really need that many people? I think I could do it with about 12 people. And they said, who's going to set up your green screen? And I said, well, can I shoot the movie without the green screen? And they said, well, who's going to set up your lights? And I was like, well, do I really need lights? And they said, okay, fine. If you can convince your actors to live there with you, you can do it, but you'll never convince them. So I call up Michael Fassbender. I said, Michael, yeah, I need you to live on this lighthouse location with me. And will you do it? And he said, no. And I said, look, Michael, you're like the best actor. I was like, there's nothing I can do that's going to make you better. You're fine without me. I can't whisper something in your ear to make a light bulb go off. But what I can give you is an experience. And then what I can fight for you is an experience. So if you embrace this gift I'm trying to give to you, I think we could do something interesting. I think we could find some life up on the screen. And he said, okay, I'll give it a day. And that day turned into 2 days, eventually turned into like 5.5 weeks. And him and myself and Alicia and about a 12-person crew lived on this little, this peninsula called Cape Campbell. And we, you know, were able to like wake up at 5 a.m. and start shooting the sunset. And we were able to, the wind was like so intense there that it threatened to like roll our trailers into the ocean every night. And so we would wake up frazzled, you know, because like the wind can really drive you crazy, you know. And to me, it just added, it was like part of the X factor of the movie. I love process when I'm making movies, so I kind of want to live it if I can.
You've compared this film to being like a John Cassavetes movie inside a David Lean, with a David Lean sweep to it.
Yeah.
For people that aren't familiar with Cassavetes, he's someone that a lot of filmmakers reference.
Yeah.
What is it that makes him so enduring and so special as a filmmaker, aside from what he could do with little money, I guess?
Yeah, well, Cassavetes, you know, the first movie I saw of his was Faces. And, you know, like I said, when I was a kid, I used to think that what went on inside my house was not what was seen by the real world. And when I saw Faces, it felt like a home movie to me. Mm. It felt like what life was like inside my house. And it didn't feel like a movie. It felt like real life, but kind of like a heightened version of real life. It felt like more intense even than real life. And then it had this amazing catharsis at the end. It's like, I left just being shell-shocked by that movie, you know? And I started watching the rest of his movies, and I think what Cassavetes did is he had this way with actors. He had this way to kind of, like, make them, you know, give the bravest performances. He had people who weren't easily defined. He had people that were, at one part, heroes and despicable at the same time. And they were human. He really made just these brave human movies. And he would use his friends and his wife to be in them, and he'd shoot them in his house, and he would edit them in his garage for years. And they're movies that are just so alive. And he's absolutely like he's the North Star to me, you know, whenever I make a film.
Yeah. You have a stellar cast. I mean, your two leads, you've got some great Antipodean actors in support, but specifically Michael Fassbender and Alicia Vikander, they feel like they're right at the top of their games. Alicia Vikander seems unnaturally gifted, almost. I'm really interested in how you came, because I understand that you hadn't really seen any of her work.
I hadn't. No.
Before you cast her, and then you had this long meeting with her, like a 4-hour chat, which sounds pretty intense. Yeah. Is that audition stroke conversation stroke get to know me process, do you see that as quite a private thing? Would you share what that's actually like, how you put an actor through their paces in that situation?
Yeah, it's pretty private to me because, say this, like with that character of Isabel, I needed to find someone who was emotionally impulsive, right? I told my casting director, I said, I want Vivian Leigh from Gone with the Wind. I want Jenna Rollins from Woman Under the Influence, or I want Emily Watson from Breaking the Waves.
You're not asking much.
No, my three favorite performances of all time. And she said, well, you should meet Alicia Vikander. And Alicia came into this meeting, to this casting, and I normally hate doing auditions. I don't like auditioning actors because usually if they're really good in an audition, I feel like I can't trust it because all that's telling me is that they're a good faker, that they're good at faking it in this nondescript room, and then if I bring them out to real life, they're just going to fake it all over the place. So I don't trust it. The other danger of an audition is that you could get it in the audition, and that's happened to me one time where I got just the best improv in an audition, and then I tried to go to set and get the same thing, and I could never get it again. I could never repeat it. So I don't want to spoil a moment on an audition, right? So usually in auditions, I just talk to people. I just get to know like what's in their heart, what's in their mind, what's haunting them, what their dreams are. And I did all that with Alicia, but I felt like I needed to see, since I didn't know much about her as an actor, I felt like I just needed to see something. Mm-hmm. So I had to do a couple scenes. And she did the most remarkable thing for me in these performances. It wasn't that she was good. It's that she was courageous, because she completely embarrassed herself at times for me. She completely went over, she fell on her face. She failed for me. And to me, that's the greatest gift an actor can give you as a director is to fail, is to be bad. Because I feel like if they can not have this, you know, kind of internal judgment of getting it right or getting it wrong, that they can be open. They can be more open. They can be more vulnerable. And because of like what she was able, how far she was able to go in that audition, I knew I could take her. I knew I could go on this journey with her. And she, you know, Michael is undoubtedly like, to me, he's like the modern Laurence Olivier. You know what I mean? He's like this incredibly trained actor who one take, maybe two takes, he's got it, mm-hmm. right? He's got your scene. What I had with Alicia was this thoroughbred that was you couldn't exhaust her, so she would keep going and going and going. What she did, she stepped onto set to go toe-to-toe with Michael Fassbender, who was like the heavyweight champ, and he couldn't get her down in two rounds, right? They had to keep going, sometimes up to like 30 takes of a scene. And her ability to kind of push it and push it and push it like made him try harder. And so I had this amazing experience of these two great actors kind of raising the bar for each other. And then the higher they would go, the more dangerous it would be for them. And then eventually they would catch each other. And so I saw not only this competition between two actors making each other better, but also this compassion for each other.
So just to contextualize slightly, they play a couple. They've suffered miscarriages and real pain living on this island, and the baby is washed ashore, and they're left with this moral conundrum. It's almost a biblical issue, I guess.
True.
I just wondered about just the mechanics of directing with children. Are you a good director of babies?
You know, to me as a director, it's all about balancing control and chaos. The great thing about working with like babies or like dogs is that you can't control them. You know what I mean? You cannot tell them what to do. They just do it. And, you know, there was a moment in the movie when they first bring the baby in, and I know the baby was like crying, and there was talk of like, can we get a doll in here? You know what I mean? Because they're interrupting the scene. And I remember telling Alicia and Michael, I was like, if the baby cries, try to calm it down. That's the job of a mother or father, like console the baby. So all of a sudden the baby was over their lines, but their lines didn't matter because they had to nurture a child now. Mm-hmm. And so we let that happen, and I felt like it was a gift to them as actors. It gave them something to distract them from trying to get their lines out. And so, yeah, I try to always embrace chaos if I can. You know, that's why we shot on this island with wind. The sound guy hated my guts, you know, because he was like, I can't hear anything. I was like, well, then the actors are going to have to speak up. The hairstylist hated me because she was like, her hair won't stay in place. It's too windy here. I was like, that's the way it is. You know, we are not making, we're not trying to make this perfect, superficial portrayal of humanity. We're trying to embrace humanity for all of its flaws, you know, and that's where Cassavetes comes in too as an inspiration. It's just like, embrace the ugliness, the terrible beauty.
Famously, Steven Spielberg loved Blue Valentine, which is kind of a circuitous way that this project came to you via DreamWorks. Yeah. Obvious question is, like, what's your favourite Spielberg movie? But I wondered if there's a Spielberg movie that you feel is particularly unfairly underrated.
When Spielberg told me that he loved Blue Valentine, I told him that I always thought Blue Valentine was like E.T. without the alien. And that I always felt, you know, Spielberg is a suburban kid, as am I, and I always related to that suburban. I felt like he always had his finger on the pulse of being a suburban kid, like growing up in Colorado in the suburbs. That was, he knew what it felt like to be a kid in that environment and how to deal with kind of the nightmare of your family like falling apart when the aliens come and visit you. You know, so I love all those movies. You know, I love, you know, Close Encounters, and I love Jaws, and I love E.T. and Indiana Jones. I mean, how can you deny what that guy has done? My favorite underrated Spielberg film.
Where do you stand on The Terminal, for instance?
You know, I liked it. I liked it. There was a moment in there with Tom Hanks eats a cheeseburger or something in the terminal, and then on the right side of his mouth he has a little bit of yellow mustard, and on the left side of his mouth he has a little bit of red ketchup. And it was the only thing I will say is it seemed preordained that it was going to land like that. It didn't seem like a mistake, and part of me recoils against that because I like to have true mistakes, but part of me is just absolutely just gobsmacked by Spielberg's control, like his ability to like go in there and create these mistakes and have complete like puppet mastery over them. And yeah, I mean, he's just undeniable. He's undeniable in his, he's like Oz, really. You know, Spielberg, he was such a great like support to me while I was making the film. He was shooting Bridge of Spies while I was shooting this, and he would watch every inch of my dailies, you know, and I shot 209 hours. Wow. So he was shooting Bridge of Spies and going home and watching his dailies and watching my dailies, and he would send me reports. And you know, he was sent me just the most beautiful messages about like how inspired he was by watching my footage, and how his footage was completely different than my footage, but yet we were both dealing with this magical mystery that is cinema. We're both telling stories through this mysterious form that is cinema. And it's just, it's like when he is watching your what you're doing and giving you those, you know, like, you know, don't forget he was like the judge at Cannes who gave Blue is the Warmest Color the top prize, and to me he loves cinema. And it was a dream come true to work with him.
You have another project coming up, which I want to ask you about, Empire of the Summer Moon, which sounds a little different from your films to date. Has Steven Spielberg given you any ideas on this one?
No, Spielberg's not involved in this one. This is a film for Warner Brothers. It's a film based on S.C. Gwynne's history of the Comanche Nation in America. It's about Quanah Parker and the last free Comanches on the plains of America, and it's about Ranald McKenzie, who was the greatest Indian fighter the U.S. Cavalry's ever seen. He's a guy who actually ended his life in an insane asylum because he had to really sell his soul to win this land battle that the U.S. government had against the Native Americans. And, you know, it's a film that takes place, you know, Comancheria, you know, ekes into a little bit of Colorado where I'm from, and it's this landscape that I grew up in. But now, you know, as a kid, I used to travel around Texas, and there's Home Depots everywhere, and there's McDonald's, and it blows my mind to think about all of the culture and the life and the lifestyle and the civilization that was really wiped out so that capitalism could thrive, you know. Yeah. And it's a film that's just trying to tell this honest American story. You know, Light Between Oceans is the first film I've made that takes place outside of America, and I'm very excited to go back and make a epic American, you know, tale of the American West. And it's also a film really though about family, because it's about Quanah Parker and his mother, Cynthia Ann Parker. Cynthia Ann Parker is basically who Natalie Wood's character was based upon in The Searchers. Right. She was a white Baptist girl who was kidnapped from her family when she was like 8 years old, and 20 something odd years later she was rescued by the Texas Rangers So twice in her life, she was abducted. One time she was abducted from her mom and dad, and the second time she was abducted from her husband and her children. And it's really the story of this son, Quanah, and his brother Peanuts trying to find their mother again, who's been taken back into white civilization. And this white civilization that can't understand why she's not, like, your home now, Cynthia. But that's not her home anymore. You know, her home was with the Comanches. And anyway, it's just a really conflicted American story of the West. And I haven't seen it yet in an American Western. You know, I've seen John Wayne Westerns, which I love, but which are, you know, inherently have some, you know, issues of perspective. And then I've seen, like, the Kevin Costner versions, which also have other issues of perspective. You know, I mean, they're all great movies. I don't want to diss them, but this, I feel like, is trying to tell, you know, more of a truthful version of, you know, as far as I can see, of what happened.
Are you anywhere near casting news on this one?
No, not yet. Not yet. I'm on my fifth draft right now.
Oh, okay.
I actually should be there writing it right now.
Sorry.
But I'm talking about my past. No.
Well, we'll let you
get back to it.
That's a good problem. Let you get back to it. Derek St. Franz, thank you so very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Real pleasure.
Pleasure's mine.
Okay, we're going to shift things around, as I said, because of the sad farewell to Emma. We're leaving on the question to the end. So we're going to put the reviews in the middle, and we're going to start with The Light Between Oceans. Emma, take the lead.
So The Light Between Oceans is a tale of Tom Sherborne, played by Michael Fassbender, a lighthouse keeper sent out to the small island of Janus Rock to look after.
You said Janus.
It's a lighthouse.
The two-faced Roman god.
And Sherborne's recently returned from the war, and he needs an escape, as you can well imagine, which he finds in both the island and peppy local girl Isabel Graysmark, who's played by Alicia Vikander. And as only tends to happen in the movies, the pair fall hopelessly in love and get married after he whisks her away to The Rock. Not the guy, Janus Rock, wow. Just to clarify. But the dynamics of their idyllic married existence eventually change due to a terrible series of miscarriages that Isabel suffers. However, a miracle happens when a teeny tiny little baby is found out at sea, and the pair decide to take it in as their own. But Tom's guilt soon gets in the way when he discovers the identity of their child's mother. And as I'm sure you can imagine, things get a little bit tangled as Tom's guilt gets stronger and the mother, played by Rachel Weisz, clocks on to what's been happening. So I know that I'm slightly more in the positive camp with this film, and the thing is about it that it has such incredible performances. Vikander is completely sublime. I think she is in pretty much everything she's done, but I think that with any other pairing, this film would have been a much harder watch. I can see why a lot of people will be turned off by it, and for me the reasons it didn't work were mainly because it feels like it's being so true to the book that it's adapted from, which I guess is a problem with a lot of adaptations.
Yeah, definitely.
But also, I'm a massive fan of Sea in France, and I love Blue Valentine. I love The Place Beyond the Pines. They're probably two of my favourite films, actually. But they work so well because they feel so effortlessly different, and this has such a conventional narrative. And maybe because I knew it was him, I'm kind of expecting more the whole way through, if that makes sense. So, as I said, I know I'm in the minority because I would go more towards the 4 stars, but I was left completely bereft. There's no spoiler. I just, for some reason, at the end of it, I was just weeping. There's two friends sitting next to me, and they just walked away. I was like, I need a bit of time here. It hit me hard, and as I said, I'm pretty sure it was all down to the performances. And also, as the kind of score guru in the corner of the pod booth, I hate to say it, but I actually found Alexandra Desplat's score a little bit overbearing.
No.
Sorry, Alexandra. Alexandra.
Take that, Desplat.
Take that, Desplat. I actually am really interested to see how it would have worked if it had a contemporary score, because for me, as I was watching it the whole time, I just kept thinking, this is a beautiful film, looks stunning, but it just would have given it this really different element that I think would have worked much better for it. And I also really need to express my love for the teeny tiny little bundle who plays the sort of toddler version of Emily, the child that they take in. She's called Florence Cleary, and it's not just because she's from my hometown, but she is absolutely lovely. She's so natural in it, and yes, she's very, very English, and this is set sort of, you know, off the coast of Australia, and they've got Kiwi accents, but she gets away with her English accent completely, and it's really, really sweet. Just her and Fassbender, stuff you can tell has obviously been, they're just allowed to roam and play free and whatever. It's absolutely gorgeous. So on a rewatch, I don't know how I'd feel with it, but in the moment of that film, it really swept me up because of those two. I really bought into it, and maybe because they are a real life couple, it's hard to separate sometimes, but you could watch them falling in love on the screen, if that made sense. And I think that is what worked for me. I don't know, a lot of people are like, it's very, very Oscar baity, blah blah blah. It's a nice romantic, sad, sweeping epic, really.
Yeah.
But it's
not a very old-fashioned movie.
It really is, but it's not going to be for everyone. A lot of people think it's quite boring. I've heard a lot of people say, unfortunately. But again, I think because Sian France has done such great stuff in the past, it's hard to separate that, really.
I have to agree. I absolutely, like you said there just a couple of minutes ago, I like you, I love Sian France. I love Sian Paris. I love Sian Lyon.
Toulouse?
No, I don't like Toulouse.
Okay.
I like to win.
I haven't been there. It must be up in the Alps.
What's happening?
That was accident as well.
Anyway, what would you give this? So we've given this three in the magazine.
Given three, yeah.
What would you give it in TripAdvisor?
Oh, it's very windy, but it's very picturesque. I'd probably give it a 4.8.
A 4.8 on TripAdvisor?
Is that a five? Is it? I've never used TripAdvisor.
You've never used TripAdvisor?
No. No, I haven't.
Wow.
Sorry.
Wow. Okay.
I don't know what to say to that.
Well, no, we should probably just move
I'm a bit stunned. Three stars then for The Light Between Oceans. Next up, we have Ben Affleck in The Accountant. He's not just an accountant. He's also one of the world's greatest assassins. So, makes sense. Doesn't it really?
So he's an autistic guy with a gift for mathematics. Mm. And after quite a sort of tough love childhood, he, you know, finds a way to basically use his skills as best he can while sort of slightly insulating himself, I guess, from a world that he finds very difficult. And I think, you know, Ben Affleck's clearly put a lot of work into trying to portray that fairly, although I'm not sure how much the script supports him. But anyway, everything is kind of going okay for him, because what he does is he uses his enormous gifts to help some slightly dodgy people with their accounts. In the words of the FBI, he uncooks the books for all of these extremely dodgy people and sort of finally launders their money. The problem is that a Treasury investigator, Raymond King, who's played by J.K. Simmons, is kind of on his tail and starts sniffing around him. And so he's under pressure to do something a bit more legitimate to try and throw him off the trail. And he takes what appears to be a legitimate job. And unfortunately, it turns out to be not quite so legitimate. Oh, no!
Dun, dun, dun!
He also meets a plucky young accountant, which is not a phrase I use very often, played by Anna Kendrick, who sort of becomes a bit of a confidant, fair? Sort of, mentee.
Yeah, they end up going and running together a little bit. A little bit. Christian Wolfe, to give him his name.
Oh, sorry, I should, yes. Christian Wolfe.
Finds himself in the crosshairs of John Bernthal, who is a loquacious hitman with incredible hair, who is on the path of Christian Wolfe. We gave this two stars in the magazine. I think it's a little harsh, I'll be honest. This is a film directed by Gavin O'Connor, and one thing you can say for this film is that it doesn't play it safe. It's
That's
bonkers.
True.
It is demented. It is numerous things. So it's about an autistic accountant who is one of the world's greatest killing machines, and that's that. If you start with that and you're okay with that, I honestly thought this movie was going to engender a lot more controversy than it has. I spoke to Gavin O'Connor for a piece for the magazine, and he was worried about it. He really was, but it seems to have come out in the States, and people haven't really batted an eyelid, and it's done pretty well. The box office, not amazingly, but okay. But it's just it's completely insane. It's about six movies. It's about six movies in one. There's a chase story. There's a kind of love story. There's an interesting relationship which echoes a thematic concern that Gavin O'Connor has explored in some of his previous movies, and I can't state
well
what that
there.
Is
well
because
there, Chris, yeah.
Otherwise people will see one of the film's major twists coming, and it has many twists as well. It is a labyrinthine story. It's very, very deeply bonkers. It's a bit like Leon at times as well. It's got some good action sequences, decent performances across the board, and just for swinging for the fences with an idea this insane and handled it, I think, in a fairly tasteful way, I think it's better than two stars. But I am also aware that I'm utterly alone in that, in the Empire office.
You kind of are, Chris.
I'm completely alone in that, but there you go.
I haven't seen it yet, and I notoriously like everything that people hate, so
You might like this.
Five stars thrower.
Hey, now.
I didn't love it by any stretch of the imagination, but I certainly don't think it's a 2-star film. But there you go. The Accountant. 2 stars. Which is not a recommendation. Although, I don't know, maybe it's tax deductible. Who knows? Maybe you can bump it up to 3 stars because of some jiggery pokery with the numbers.
Whoa, steady on.
Last but not least, this week, and very, very quickly, sadly, because we need to ask some questions of Emma. Nocturnal Animals, Tom Ford's second immaculately tailored movie.
It is immaculately tailored, yes. And this is the first of a 1-2 Amy Adams punch coming this week and next.
Hell yeah.
For my money, the second one's much better. Anyway, this is a story that, based on a book called Tony and Susan. And Susan is played by Amy Adams. And she's a very wealthy sort of gallery owner, living the high life, married to Armie Hammer, who's a businessman who goes off on lots of trips and gets up to lots of stuff while he's away. And one day she gets sent a manuscript from her ex, who's played by Jake Gyllenhaal. And it's a revenge story set in the desert. It's about a man who he and his wife and daughter are basically targeted by some ne'er-do-wells in the desert, and he sort of tries to sort things out. But the film is kind of a layered story between that book that she's reading, where Gyllenhaal also plays the main character, and you have Michael Shannon as the investigator who tries to help him figure out what happened and catch the people responsible. And then you also snap back to Susan's life in LA as she reads this book. So there's a lot, I have to say, there's a lot of scenes where Tom Ford has to make somebody reading a book look interesting, which is a challenge for any director, and it's one that I'm not 100% sure he entirely nails. But basically, there are parallels between what happened in real life between Adams and Gyllenhaal's characters and what happens in the book, and I can't say any more than that or it would give it away. Now, this is beautifully composed. It's gorgeously shot. Seamus McGarvey, fantastic, fantastic work on this. As you would expect, everything looks glorious.
Yeah.
As you would expect from this cast, the performances are great. Michael Shannon in a smaller role is just wonderful. And I think injects a little bit of, not levity, but just offbeat weirdness that I think the film really needed. And I think it hugely benefits from it. I personally had major, major issues with the end of this and find it really unpleasant. And so I am a little bit out of step. I'm like yourself, Chris, on the last one. I'm a little bit out of step. However, I can't deny it's beautifully made, well shot, well directed. I just hate the story, I think.
Okay.
We gave it 4 stars.
Yes.
I wouldn't.
So 4 stars for Nocturnal Animals.
Yeah.
Why don't you take the star off?
And give it to you.
And give it to me. I'll bung it on the accountant.
Uh-huh.
And then we're happy.
I'll tell you what, but I'll also take 2 stars off. I'll give one to Emma as well.
Well, I'd give Nocturnal Animals 5 stars, so...
This is insane. Really?
Yeah, it's one of my favourite films of the year. Top 5 of the year for me.
Okay.
I absolutely loved it. I think it's a, without saying too much, it's a narrative device I've never really seen used to that effect before. Mm-hmm. I think it's absolutely stunning. I think visually and story-wise, it's just incredibly arresting. Amazing score, again.
Yeah, amazing score.
From
I'll give it that, yeah.
Abel Kozelowski. You pronounce it.
Nailed it.
And Amy Adams, again.
Amy Adams
is amazing.
Hell
of a time.
But I have to say, if she wins the Oscar this year after 5 nominations, which, let's face it, is as many as Leo had before he won, I think she should win for Arrival, personally. And I will be a little bit disappointed if she wins for Nocturnal Animals or if she splits her own vote.
I think she should win for...
She's doing 2 for leading, apparently.
I think she should win for a performance that she deserves it for, unlike Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh
snap.
Mic drop. I've said it before.
I think she, without wishing to give anything away or break any embargoes, she's going to have some serious competition this year from a certain Ms. Portman, among others.
Oh yeah.
Anywho, so Nocturnal Animals, 4 stars.
Crack that code.
It's a really easy code to crack, let's be fair.
It's barely a code.
Wow.
It's pretty much just
even
a letter.
Benjamin Franklin Gates could crack that code.
Oh, Johnny isn't here.
I know. All right, so let's make some sense of this nonsense. So The Light Between Oceans is 3 stars. That is a recommendation, as we always say in the podcast. The Accountant is 2 stars. It's not a recommendation, but I say, you know what? You know what? If you like batshit insane films that features Ben Affleck killing a lot of people, go and see it. And then we have Nocturnal Animals, which was a little bit less up on than the Empire Review. 4 stars, but you know, Helen's. But then Emma thinks it's 5, so it's a complete curveball. So I don't know what to think anymore. What I do know is that you shouldn't go see A Stray Cat Named Bob, which we gave 2 stars to. We don't have time really to talk about it in this one, but sadly, it's a bit maudlin. But there you go.
Yeah, I think just the tone is a little bit confused. It can't decide if it's Ken Loach or Paddington.
I can't think of any cat puns.
Well, that's a recommendation. That is a recommendation.
That is actually.
I want to see that film.
I, Daniel Bear. That'd be amazing.
Oh. Would watch.
Would watch. Okay, so that's it for the reviews. And now, before we say goodbye to Emma Thrower, here is a lovely bunch of questions that you guys have been sending in via Twitter. The first one comes from Lat American Claire, at American Claire, and also Lat American Claire. What's a film you love despite a bad soundtrack?
Ooh.
See,
is it even possible?
Do you know what? It's an awful question because... No, sorry, that's a great question. But it's an awful question for me because I think I only tend to really recognise greatness.
You have a blind spot.
But I'm such a... You know I'm a really positive person.
Yeah.
So I'm never like, oh, that score's terrible. It's more forgettable or... So yeah. Do you know what?
So you try to forget them.
I'm going to start off with a really, really bad answer and say, ugh, I don't have an answer. It's more, say if something's feels a bit overbearing or incongruous, like, Carter Burwell's score for Legend springs to mind. I had trouble with that. It just felt really out of step with the film.
As in the Craze movie?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, that's American.
Not the Tom Cruise movie.
No.
That wasn't Carter Burwell.
That, again, would be a really bad score for that movie.
I mean, yeah.
If you took the score from the Craze movie Legend and put it on the Tom Cruise movie, Ridley Scott movie.
It might be more fun than
it might be more fun.
The Craze movie was.
Indeed. So, because you haven't been with us long, Emma, but you've established yourself right from the off as a lover of film scores, so quite a few questions about
I noticed. Sort of stuff. I had to actually write answers in case they came up because I didn't want to embarrass myself. I needed them ready, just in case.
Gotta prepare. At Miller Time 1976 asks, if Emma could have an Avengers-style film but with composers, who would they be?
Okay, this is what I needed to prepare.
So this is composers coming together to face a dire threat. For example, like a Bieber-level threat, and they have to come together to...
That could happen.
Yeah?
They're like super team.
Like if you think about Close Encounters of the Third Kind, they communicate through music. So these composers would be communicating with, say, the Chitauri through music.
That's amazing.
This is, I think we're going to make a fortune.
Okay, so bear with me here. They're going to be brought together by Nick Fury, aka John Williams, because he's the Don, right? And then he's going to employ Hans Zimmer, Coulson, to get the gang together.
Okay.
So, Iron Man. Yeah. Mansell, obviously. Captain America, Michael Giacchino.
Oh, of course he is.
Because he's so
American.
Righteous and
he's
lovable.
He's so American and cuddly and stuff.
Yeah. And also has had the super composer serum, so there's that whole backstory.
Yes.
We don't talk about that.
And then Thor, Dario Marinelli, because he has a really evil brother. I don't know that, but he's great.
Yeah.
Black Widow, Rachel Portman, because she's a girl and she's awesome. Hawkeye would be Ludovico Einaudi, because I've heard he's great with a bow and arrow.
Sweet.
Or at least
a bow, probably.
Right. And then the Hulk needs to be Craig Armstrong because I get angry that people don't love him as much as they should. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
And then lastly, Loki be able to cause any obstacles. Wait, because he always brings in the black magic when you don't expect it and people forget he's there.
Oh.
Okay, can I have that one?
Who's that?
Abel Kozaniowski, who I actually just did a shout out for in Nocturnal Animals.
Remember?
Yeah, no, I remember that. Yeah.
Sorry, that was a proper answer, wasn't it? You
that was a really good answer.
I hope it was the right answer, but that's my Avengers team up.
Okay, that's good. That's good. That's good. It's your team.
It is.
They would so lose. Simmer, though. Simmer's great. You know, Coulson, good choice. Connor Walshy asks, if you could revive any cancelled during production movies or TV shows, which would you choose? And he also cautions that he's going to unfollow you if you don't pick Fincher's Utopia at HBO with Rooney Mara, which kind of defeats the point of the question in the first place.
Yeah, and then I replied to him and said, I haven't started watching it yet, so...
But yeah, you couldn't because it wasn't made.
I mean, right?
That would be tricky.
That's really tough. I wish there had been... Oh, I don't know. I wish there had been more of Life on Mars, although that was perfect. This isn't me answering the question. I don't know. What's been cancelled, obviously?
I mean, I'd like to see, like... Yeah, well, I guess there's some of those. I'd like to see, like... Arnie's Crusades movie that never happened. I think that would have been hilarious.
Okay.
For example. But yeah, those kind of big movies that just didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, relevantly, talking of Fincher as well, there was, you know, the fact that we didn't get the two extra Girl with the X films.
Oh, yeah.
And they're moving on to the other book, was not Larson's. I wish we'd had, as much as I adored the Noomi Rapace ones, I would have loved to have seen the
Rooney
Mara finish. Yeah,
okay.
I love Fincher. That would have been great.
Oh, yeah, we've got to talk about that because Fede Alvarez has been, he's going to direct The Girl in the Spider's Web. They're going to reboot it, which we meant to talk about during the news. But there was so much news we forgot. So there you go. At 33 years of Dave asked, does Emma regret not watching Die Hard sooner?
Now, I've thought long and hard about this answer, and my answer is no. Because when I watched it late, I appreciated it much more. And also, I raised a lot of money for charity, so thank you to everybody who donated. And that's the right answer.
I suppose that's, I mean, selfless and everything. Have you seen The Princess Bride yet?
No.
Emma, we've talked about this
a
lot.
I'm sorry. I will soon.
At Phil Elliott asks, if you can only listen to one film soundtrack for the rest of your life, which one would you pick?
This is a toss-up. My favourite score of all time, as I've said many times, is Clint Mansell's The Fountain. But the score to Cloud Atlas, I think, has everything in it. So I hate to be disloyal to Clint, but I think, I know that score inside out, but I think something that has everything, I think I'd go with Tom Tykwer and the gang's Cloud Atlas. It's amazing, absolutely incredible. That theme, the sextet, kills me.
At elbows underscore selbo.
Every time.
These are great names. If Emma could only hang three film posters on her wall, teaser, one shot, and variant.
Oh my god.
Which would she choose?
Hanson, this one slipped through. Right. Okay, off the top of my head, I saw an amazing poster by Cakes Comics. Is it Matt Ferguson? For Kubo this week, which I'm going to call a variant because it wasn't done for theatrical, although I think it was released for some IMAX screenings.
Yeah.
Forgive me if I'm wrong. Teaser, again off the top of my head, I used to have, keeping it relevant, the Fincher's Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, because I used to work in cinema, teaser that we weren't allowed to put up because of the bar through the nipple.
Oh yeah.
My manager was like, nope, it was up for a day, and he was like, nah. So I love that. I'd have that up. It's such a great poster of Craig kind of choke holding Rooney Mara.
So you have just filth.
Those
pornography.
Kubo is not
just
filth.
Kubo is not filth.
And then Girl with a Dragon Tattoo is that's pornography.
What was the other one? A normal one.
A normal, yeah, a release poster.
I love the, I've got three of them. I love the Shame poster, the one that's half orange, half yellowy. The main theatrical poster is beautiful. That's a quad. Stunning.
I apologise, Chris. It is filth.
It is filth.
Oh, yeah, God, filth. Sorry.
No, I meant the film. The film filth by John Esper. Katie Trainer asks, while working at Empire, which film have you loved the most that you probably wouldn't otherwise have seen?
It's a bit of a cop-out answer because I don't think there's anything I wouldn't have seen, if that makes sense. But the film I've loved the most, because I've only been here, what, 14 months? I loved, my favourite film this year is, my favourite film this year is Civil War. So,
you probably would have seen that, maybe.
I mean, but let's go for a festival film, let's go for something different. My favourite festival films I saw at Edinburgh this year were The Childhood of a Leader, which I've really waxed lyrical about. I think it's incredible. Mm-hmm. And then Hunt for the Wilder People, which we've all gone crazy about.
Yeah.
So, yeah, support some smaller films. But yeah, no, I would say Child of a Leader.
At Wongo the Insane.
These names says, are brilliant.
Would it have helped if Chris Hewitt had recorded the podcast with his trousers on?
Yeah.
It's what we all want.
It's what you want, Helen. It's not what I want. And what I want is just to be free during the podcast. Just to flap around. Flap around free. At Papworth Amy asks, what's been the best moment of your time at Empire?
I was really lucky. My first interview was with Aaron Sorkin, which for me was like the best thing ever.
That's just like, you should just quit right then.
I could have talked to him for about 3 days straight. He is fascinating. And we broke down his best scenes. So I was sitting there like an absolute fan. Like, this is very cool. Recently, I was really lucky. I got to go and watch Clint Mansell's most recent score being recorded, which was so dreamy. Thank you, Helen.
You're welcome.
And then actually queuing for The Force Awakens of Nick and James, because there are so few films where we have that kind of massive, you know, event films. We don't.
You were behind us in the queue.
So that was really cool. Chris Hemsworth pretending to be a whale at me. That was good. He does a really terrible sperm whale impression. But that stuck with me. Yeah, I've been super lucky. So J.J. Abrams, I think, was probably my absolute highlight, though. That was his passion is like so infectious.
That was awesome. You got like 45 minutes with him, didn't you?
Yeah, for 10 Cloverfield Lane. It was nuts. And the first thing goes is, do you want a drink? And I was like, oh, you're totally normal. So enough. But yeah,
you're totally normal. Would you totally want a drink? Normal. Oh, you drink fluids. This is amazing.
Would you like a beverage?
Just like everybody else.
But yeah, finally, on a really personal note, when I finished interviewing Viggo Mortensen, I got tangled up in my wires and he untangled me. Oh. And that was a very lovely, chivalrous moment.
We should mention that Emma is a robot and has wires trailing wherever she goes.
It was great.
Okay,
that was a lot of answers.
No, it was great. Couple more. At Chopper Style 311. Says everyone's going soundtrack questions, so I'll go a different route. Should I refinance my home mortgage?
Oh man, that's a lot of responsibility on one person's shoulders. Look, I'm going to say no, for sure. I have faith in your decisions, but I think you're going to get through this time. And I think remortgaging is a big decision. And I can barely count to 100, let alone advise on that.
It's
so
huge.
Be strong, man, okay? I'm glad you asked.
Yeah.
But don't do it.
This could launch your entire new career at moneysavingexpert.com.
Oh, man. Martin Lewis, what about him?
At Monty H. Withnell asks, with your Twitter handle having a Tarantino reference, what's your favourite Tarantino film?
Yeah, so my handle is I Am Not Wayne Gale. Wayne Gale being from Natural Born Killers. I have not seen all of his films, which is a terrible admission. I've seen most of them, but I came to him quite late. Again, you know, I guess being younger and stuff. So I really, really, really love Pulp Fiction, but that's an obvious answer. So
just go with your instinct.
I really like Django. Like, I really like Django. I think that
just name all
my
of
favorite.
Them.
No, Django. No. Okay. I think Django.
So you're I Am Not Wayne Gale.
Yeah, so everyone.
Why are you not Emma Thrower on Twitter?
Well, because that handle was taken. It's simple as that.
Yeah, by someone who's never tweeted. I'm looking at it right now.
And I heard that you can take someone's name after they haven't tweeted for X amount of years.
Yeah, not anymore.
I like my pretentious handle. I really like it.
They changed the rules. That's why I'm Chris Hewitt, because I wasn't Chris Hewitt initially, and then someone who was Chris Hewitt wasn't tweeting for ages, and so I went, oi, Twitter, give me that handle. And they went, yes, you can have that handle. Now they've stopped that.
I feel like I'm synonymous with Robert Downey Jr., though. So how could I?
I can't tell you apart. I thought you were great in Civil War.
Thank you.
At Hey Quiz asks, we always get this question, and I never put it through, but I'm going to put it through just for you. If they made a movie about the Empire podcast, who would you cast to play you?
Ben Foster. No.
Is there any role for which you would not consider Ben Foster?
That's a tough one. If someone that maybe I dream looks a bit like me, with your eyes closed, and when I used to have brown hair, Michelle Dockery is probably the only person that I've ever been remotely compared to. I look nothing like her, so I'm going to go for her because she's cool. But Ben Foster would be my answer.
Okay. Ben Foster in a wig.
Okay, two last
Pink
ones.
Pink wig.
Tariq Ashkenani asks, most tearful goodbye in movies?
Most tearful? Oh my goodness, I think the film that made me cry the most in regards to that was probably The Fountain. I don't think I've recovered.
Maybe it was just seeing Rachel Weisz again in The Light Between Oceans that made you so emotional during that movie.
Maybe it was. Maybe I'm just...
Cat Brown, a former of this parish, asks, what's the most... Because I've literally, as we're recording this, I put a shout out for more questions.
Oh, really?
Yeah. This is interactivity.
No, I'm unprepared. Okay.
What's the most underrated soundtrack?
Oh, non-mainstream movie scores people don't know about. I really like... What should people know? Like Crazy by Dustin Halloran is amazing. Also, Eye Origins, a film that not enough people have seen either. Will Bates and Phil Mossman, that score is gorgeous. I listen to that nearly every day.
Oh, wow.
There's a recent film which I don't know what the hell is going to happen, but it's released. It's called American Hero with Stephen Dorff and Lorne Balfour's... I don't know how you pronounce his name, sorry. Lorne Balfour. His score is beautiful. It's all piano That's really gorgeous. So.
Okay, awesome. Two last questions. At jmizzle222 asks, if Emma could have any actor read her a story, which story would she ask Lee Pace to read?
Oh, who just mentioned Lee Pace?
Jordan Milnes.
Wow, I've never seen someone actually faint before.
Because I nearly mentioned him, is it, at Ben Foster? What story would Lee Pace read me?
Mm-hmm.
I've actually lost the plot a bit, haven't I?
I think a transcript of this podcast. Oh, that's God. What we need, with him doing all the voices.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just answering questions for you now. And the very last question
is
at See Me Here, what will you miss most about the podcast?
Oh.
About Empire, in fact.
I was going to say editing it. Do you know what? One of the very, very best things about this job, editing the podcast is so good because you guys never hear half of the ridiculous stuff that happens in here. There are so many great outtakes, and John and I were never on the podcast together, by the way. So
really,
did anyone ever see us in the same room? I don't know. Are we the same person?
You've never been on the podcast together.
Not together. Never did it. I know, right?
Wow.
So we were thinking of doing like an outtakes one this year, but there's just
I would go to prison.
it's Dan Jolin
as your lawyer.
It would amazing.
Be, yeah, it would be very, very bad. It would be bad.
That's a lot of fun. We just laugh. Chris makes me cry of laughter at least once a week, let's be honest. I do often have to go and grab a pile of tissues to sort my face out.
Well, on that bombshell, how can I possibly recover from that? That is, I have to, okay. I think that's a good note in which to end, to be honest. I will say, on a personal note, it's, you know, we haven't known you long enough. It's been just over a year. You've brought incredible bubbly fun to the office. You've reminded us every day of what aching dinosaurs we are, which is, we really are. We're so old, this young, driven, capable person.
Yeah. We're sort of creaking in a corner.
Yeah, absolutely. I had to clear cobwebs off myself just the other day. Really,
I'll be honest,
sad.
You didn't get them all. There's
no, I didn't. Yeah, it's been wonderful having you. It's fair to say it sucks to be losing you, Helen.
It 100% does.
Yeah.
It's been good to have another Hamilton appreciator around the office. It's been good to have another girl around the office, and you know,
I could be a girl.
You're not a girl.
I could be.
All right, Beyonce. But yeah, you're going to be missed very much for yourself.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And yes, thank you for laughing at all my jokes.
You're very welcome.
That will be missed, because that doesn't
No
happen.
One else is going to do it anymore.
No one else does that. It's really sad. Anything to say? Any last words?
Oh, good Lord. That's.
I know.
Do we have to call them last words?
We might as well.
Just teach us how to say goodbye.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, I get so many people asking about the scores these last 2 days. So if anyone wants to follow me on Spotify, it's a great shout. So it's very embarrassing. This is my email from when I was 12. I'm sorry. But it's Eminem. As in Eminem and Emma, because yes, I like to rap to Eminem. Eminem 12 on Spotify, super easy, and there are so many lists.
Super easy, she says,
so many
saying a word that I have no idea how to spell. It's Eminem. It's
Eminem with an M A on the end. Eminem.
It makes
sense. Or tweet me and ask.
Yeah, my brain hurts.
But yes,
Eminem.
We can enjoy the scores together forever.
It's Eminem with an M A.
Yeah, 1-2.
Now I just have visions of Eminem going
as
to university.
As a master's.
Just like, what would that be? What would he be doing? But there you go. Awesome. We hope you've enjoyed your time on the podcast. And listen, you know, the door is open because there are two doors.
That's
how Helen is established. We cannot stop people coming into the pod.
Can't kick me out.
Yeah, just daintily skip around Mick downstairs. Hey, he'll say. And then run up the stairs.
You self-hating racist.
Self-hating racism. How is that self? Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Adam Driver.
Is that next week?
It's next week.
Yay.
We're nothing if not prepared for this podcast. Helen's about to interview Adam Driver this afternoon, so yes, don't fuck it up, because it's meant to be our podcast interview next week.
I'll do my best.
There you go. Alright, it's goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from me, and for the final time, at least for now, it's goodbye from Emma Thrower.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening. See you next week. Bye.